This episode sponsored by We Feed Raw. Have you ever actually looked at the label on your dog's food? Most dog food labels are a long list of things that don't look like food. Powders, starches, additives used to hold ultra-processed kibble together. At We Feed Raw, the label looks very different. High-quality meat, nutrient-rich organs, complete and balanced nutrition formulated by PhD nutrition experts. No fillers, no artificial preservatives, just real ingredients that support your dog's whole body health. That's why many pet parents see real changes after switching to We Feed Raw's fresh meals. If you want to feed your dog one of the healthiest diets possible, We Feed Raw makes it simple. Right now, new customers can get 40% off their starter box plus free shipping. Visit We Feed Raw at wefeedraw.com to get started today.
And we are back with another episode of the Kyle Lanzalone Show. And I am absolutely honored today to be joined by Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who, of course, was the American diplomat in Saudi Arabia and also served as the translator for President Nixon when he went to China. Ambassador Freeman, how are you doing today, sir?
Never better. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, I'm really happy that you're here. There's so much going on in the world, and it all centers on diplomacy and really Trump's inability to make a deal. So a lot I want to talk to you about today. Trump extends the Trump's upcoming meeting with Xi and the role of diplomats. What are they actually supposed to do in the world? So yesterday, Tuesday, just hours before the two-week ceasefire before the U.S. and Iran was sent to expire, Donald Trump put out this post on Truth Social claiming that the Iranian government was too fragmented to negotiate with the United States of America, and therefore he was going to continue the ceasefire. He didn't say how long the ceasefire would be extended for. Today, we had a report from Axios that said Trump is planning on giving Tehran 5 days for the government to get a cohesive plan together and submit it to the United States. So, Ambassador Freeman, I want to start off with Trump's premise behind this whole ceasefire extension, that the Iranian government is simply too fragmented and divided in order to negotiate with the U.S. at this time. Do you agree with Trump's assessment there?
Not really. pardon me. I think the Iranian government is, in fact, in some respects divided, but not significantly. It was able to overcome divisions to attend the Islamabad meeting with Vice President J.D. Vance and his minders, Kushner and Witkoff. And I don't think it's really divided now on the main issue, which is that it's not prepared to accept another ultimatum from the United States. There are really no negotiations being proposed by America. It is ignoring the military realities this war has produced and insisting on Iranian surrender. And that's just not in the cards. And I don't think the Iranians have any difficulty in refusing that. So I think the basic thesis that somehow or other maximum pressure will force the Iranians to capitulate is just as mistaken as it was in the case of North Korea, where maximum pressure produced a nuclear weapon on an ICBM aimed at the United States, and now with multiple warheads. The same result is going to happen with Iran. Sooner or later, we're going to have to come to grips with the realities that Iran has interests, it will not surrender, and we will have to find a way to deal with them.
So, sir, let's say that by some miracle, Donald Trump wakes up tomorrow and gives you a call and says, Ambassador Freeman, you've done some good work in the past, and now I need some guidance on how to approach the Iranians at this point in time. What do you tell the president? How do we start to break the ice from here when tensions are already so high. The U.S. has issued these maximalist demands, and they're nowhere near what Iran has put forward in their 10-point plan.
Well, I think the 10-point plan from Iran was basically accepted by the president as the framework for discussions, but then he set it aside. If he's really prepared to discuss those issues, then let's do so. But I think there needs to be some preparation. This war was started without any consultation with American allies, partners, or friends. It has deeply affected their interests. They are not being consulted by us about how to end this war, what is acceptable and what isn't. Donald Trump says, well, we're not dependent on the Strait of Hormuz. They are, so they should come and do something about it. But if we're not dependent on it, why are we there? Why are we conducting a blockade? I think we need to come to grips with reality. And the reality is that while Iran has not won the war, it has not been beaten. And we have basically failed to achieve any of the stated objectives with which we entered this war. Iran's nuclear program, which was non-existent in the, according to intelligence agencies here and in Israel and elsewhere, is now a reality. Iran has been convinced successfully that it requires a nuclear deterrent to avoid being attacked again by Israel and the United States. There has been no regime change in Iran, unless you count the consolidation of the regime around a tough nationalist line, some kind of regime change. The Iranian inventory of missiles has been reduced, but not eliminated, and it's ready to go again, apparently. The Strait of Hormuz, which was open, is now closed. You can't deal with that, by the way, with a blockade. Not only is a blockade a slow approach to putting pressure on anyone, but it is injuring all of our allies, friends, partners abroad, as well as our adversaries. And it's not sustainable, both because the political pressure from them will rise steadily and because the wear and tear on our Navy is great. Finally, this blockade is not legal. A blockade, to be legal, must be effective. This is not effective. Ships are getting through. It must be limited to a geographical area. We are not doing that. The last action we took was in the Bay of Bengal off Sri Lanka, very far away from Iran. It must be conducted in a manner that is objective rather than subjective, not arbitrary and capricious. And we don't know what the rules of engagement are. They're certainly not effective. So we are on a track to nowhere. The only thing I can say that is relevant to this is that I'm enormously impressed by two things. One, Donald Trump's ability to lie or confabulate. And second, by the gullibility of traders on the New York Stock Exchange. Every time he says peace is at hand, there's a 15% drop in the price of oil and a 15% increase in the price of shares. Then he turns out, presumably, somebody has made a lot of money off that. There's a lot of irregular trading going on with a strong suspicion that it is connected to corruption by people around Trump, if not Trump personally. We're now in a situation where the market is finally going to have to come to grips with the fact that this war has not ended. There is no ceasefire. There is no prospect of a ceasefire. There is no framework for negotiations. There are negotiations, no negotiations going on. And the tensions and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz will continue as long as Iran decides they should. And we can't change that.
Absolutely. And I do have this article here that this is from the Financial Times yesterday. At least 34 tankers with links to Iran have bypassed the U.S. blockade since the demand. So for all of Trump's claims that we're depriving the Iranian government of $500 million a day with this blockade, that doesn't seem to be the case. Now, I did want to follow up on one thing that you mentioned there. You said that Iran's been convinced that they need to develop a nuclear weapon by this. And I do agree with your assessment, although I did see an interesting comment. I actually picked it up in the New York Times, who is citing Dmitry Medvedev, the former Russian president, as like an expert on this issue, who said Iran doesn't need a nuclear weapon because they've shown they have the equivalent of a nuclear weapon with the ability to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. So do you agree with that assessment that Iran's actually going to look at the situation, realize that they took an international, a historic international waterway that's responsible for 20% of energy oil flows and have turned that into effectively an Iranian river? Right. And now they get a charge a toll on it, just like you could with the Panama Canal. So is that enough of a victory for Iran, enough of a deterrent that they feel like we don't need a nuclear weapon?
I doubt it very much. I think, in fact, of course, they do have the upper hand because they have seized control of the Strait of Hormuz. And there's no way to dislodge them from that, given geography. So they have an effective way of retaliating against an attack. But they have been attacked now multiple times. This war has been going on for decades. Israel has been assassinating Iranian officials, scientists, funding opposition movements, trying to turn peaceful protests violent. And of course, now we've had two attacks on Iran, which the United States has joined, one last June and one currently not over. I think Iran will conclude, as North Korea did, that as Muammar Gaddafi failed to conclude, that it requires the ability to strike both Israel and the United States with a nuclear weapon. So the business of turning over enriched uranium and so forth I think is an enticement to a broader negotiation. Let me just make one final point here on this. We are right to be deeply concerned about the control that the Iranians exercise over this international waterway, because it sets a precedent for others to do the same. What's to stop Malaysia and Indonesia or Singapore adamantly opposed, of course, to shutting down the Strait of Malacca? What is to stop China from shutting down the Taiwan Strait? There are international waterways everywhere. There is a model for dealing with these. We've seen that in the case of the Dardanelles, meaning the passage from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean and from the Mediterranean back to the Black Sea, which after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire was removed from Turkish control kept as a no recognition of the Turkish interest in control of that waterway until 1938, when there was a new treaty developed, which recognized Turkish sovereignty and gave Turkey a management role in regulating traffic through the strait, but also established clear rules for what would and would not be proper regulation of the strait under the treaty. There needs to be some kind of international involvement in opening the Strait of Hormuz. It cannot be opened by military means. It will have to be opened by diplomatic means. And the pressures on countries to do that are very considerable. We're just at the beginning of an energy shock. The countries on the other side of the Persian Gulf, the Arab Gulf states, are all in difficulty, dependent on free passage through the Strait of Hormuz for the greater part of their revenue, or all of it, in the case of Kuwait and Qatar, Bahrain. The Saudis have an exit way of exporting through the port of Yanbu on the Red Sea coast. But the pressure to do something, to come to grips with the reality that Iran is not going away, that it will retain the capacity to punish its neighbors if they collaborate in attacks on Iran with the United States and Israel, actually have not collaborated with Israel, but with the United States. The Iranian demand is that they get rid of the American bases on their territory. And we're beginning to see people in the Gulf talking about that. So I think we're on a path to nowhere at the moment. And we really do need to rethink this. And our interests should include ensuring the least possible Iranian or other control of passage through the strait. But no control is not possible anymore.
Absolutely. Ambassador Freeman, I want to ask you where you think we go from here on this ceasefire, how long it could continue. The Iranian Speaker of the Parliament, who's been representing Tehran in negotiations with the U.S., explained that the U.S. blockade of Iranian ports is a ceasefire violation. Israel's continued destruction in southern Lebanon, whether that's through airstrikes or home demolitions, is violations of the ceasefire. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of reason for the Iranians and the Americans both to choose to stay in this period of ceasefire. Trump is threatening to blow up power plants and bridges. I mean, the U.S. could cause a lot of poverty, a lot of suffering in Iran. And, you know, we just got this report from CSIS that the U.S. stockpile of interceptors has been significantly depleted. The THAADs, the Patriots, the SM-3s and SITSs are all at like 50% compared to their pre-war levels. It's going to take 3, 4, 5 years to replenish those munitions, not to mention the radar systems that Iran has destroyed. And so the U.S. ability to actually defend Israel and our allies in the region, our troops, seems like it would be in question if we go back to war. So is there enough of incentive there for to not to go back to war, to keep this truce in place, even if it is just a fragile ceasefire that keeps getting extended? Or do you think we're in a short order going back to war?
I suspect that we are going to go back to war because there's a poverty of imagination and diplomatic thinking in Washington. We don't know how to do anything but deliver ultimata. And when we deliver them, we often have no strength behind them. By the way, I mean, it was perfectly obvious from the beginning that American defense capabilities, the ability to intercept missiles aimed at Israel, for example, would be severely depleted. In the first 5 days of this war, we fired 800 Patriots. We produced 600 a year, I believe. So in the first 5 days of this war, we wiped out more than a year's inventory of these missiles. And the same has been true. The radars for THAAD, the Theater High Altitude Air Defense System, were all knocked out on the first day. The damage that's been done to both sides is enormous. But you're absolutely correct. We can do a great deal more damage to Iran, which has suffered terribly already. But the suffering in Iran has not reduced Iranian determination to resist. Quite the contrary, it has concentrated it and reinvigorated it. And the protests that were basically protests against the consequences of our Secretary of the Treasury's, Scott Bessent's, effort to collapse the Iranian currency and thereby impoverish everybody in Iran, those protests have basically died down and they've been replaced by rallies in support of the defense of Iran. It turns out that while many Iranians probably detest the government that they're under, they love their country more than they hate the government. And this is not unusual and it's entirely predictable. So I think we may be going back to war, but we've got to come up with a better approach than a blockade. Basically, what we've done, our objective is to open the Strait of Hormuz. Iran had basically left the door ajar, and they peek out and they see who's coming or going, and if it's friendly countries' ships and cargoes that are going between friendly ports, they open the door and let them through for a fee. If they see a hostile ship or something belonging to an enemy coming, they shut the door. Well, what we've done in response to that is shut the door and padlocked it. This makes absolutely no sense in terms of our objective of sustaining reasonable energy prices and not bringing on a global recession. And of course, the radius from Iran of shipping means that it takes 3 to 5 weeks for anything exiting the Persian Gulf to reach the refineries of the other shore. That means that we're about to have a tremendous effect. It's now, 7 weeks, I guess, since this war began. And the refineries are drying up. Not just the refineries, helium supplies, aluminum supplies, fertilizer supplies, ammonia, urea supplies, gas, natural gas. All of this is now in very great shortage conditions. And we're going to see inflation like we've, to quote Donald Trump, like we've never seen before out of this. It just, you know, to buy a barrel of oil now, right now, costs you $150. Futures prices are less than $100 or around $100. This disparity reflects irrational exuberance and optimism on the part of traders. And it's going to close. We're going to be paying $7, $8, $10 a gallon at the pump. That'll have an impact on the midterms, assuming the midterms actually take place.
Yeah, I share all of your concerns there. Now, I want to ask you another question about the blockade, but this is Lindsey Graham today saying that Donald Trump is planning to expand the blockade globally, which I'm assuming means that the president is planning on any ship that left an Iranian port, he's going to send the U.S. Navy after it, whether it's in the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean. And I'm not sure that Washington, people like Lindsey Graham and Donald Trump, understand that when a ship leaves Iran and it's going to China or Indonesia or Malaysia or any other country, there are two interested parties in that ship. One, of course, is the Iranians, but the other is the receiving country. Do you see this doing damage, particularly in East Asia, where the U.S. has worked, you know, for years and years and years to build alliances and turn all these countries against China, kind of hurt our ability to have relationships with these East Asian countries if we stop or start taking the tankers that are going to their countries?
Well, ironically, China is the least affected country in Pacific Asia, because it has enormous strategic petroleum reserves, but also because it has wisely switched its energy to renewable sources. It is the world leader in solar, wind, nuclear power, hydro, it is hurt by shortages of petroleum, but it has the ability to deal with that. Our allies, Japan and South Korea, and others, are the ones who are desperately affected. And so much so that we see the Philippines, which we have been, as you indicated, trying to entice into an anti-China posture in support of our own, we see the Philippines now reaching out to China and trying to pursue compromises. It would like to be able to exploit the alleged natural gas and oil that is under the South China Sea. China has consistently offered to do that on a cooperative basis. Philippines has refused. It may now do that. So we're not thinking clearly on this at all. Just a final note, the model, as Donald Trump says, is Venezuela. And in the case of Venezuela, we engaged in what legally are acts of piracy, just exactly as you suggest. We pursued ships well beyond the Caribbean, and took them, and we actually looted the oil and kept it. Should the United States get into a firefight over a ship that's manned by the Chinese, I think anybody's guess is good. But really, the main damage at the moment is being done to Japan, to South Korea, to the Philippines, Indonesia and other countries. The main beneficiaries of this are Russia, which is now able to sell its oil without sanctions at approximately double the price it had before. You know, this oil from Iran, from Russia, was during the before the war, was being sold at a huge discount, about $47 a barrel. It's now being sold, as I said, at 150. You know, that's not bad for government work, I guess. Certainly not helpful in terms of our stated objectives.
Absolutely. It really does baffle me that Donald Trump didn't wrap up the war with Ukraine before going to war with Iran, simply because at least then he could have lifted the oil sanctions on Russia and had this deal with Putin where the Russians are flooding the world oil market and at least helping a little bit to this degree. But even as the U.S. is lifting sanctions on the Russian oil, Ukraine keeps attacking the Russian facilities and they attacked a Russian tanker in the Mediterranean. So all of this is really adding up to a bigger problem. Now, Donald Trump is supposed to travel to China to meet with President Xi next month. I'm wondering how you think, assuming that summit goes forward, how you think it's going to go. The MAGA people here in the U.S. seem to think that Donald Trump is going to go in there with a big stick, like he just won this massive war and it really hurt China, and now he's going to be in the ultimate position of power to dictate terms to Xi. Do you think that's the way it's going to go?
No, I don't. The Chinese don't think the United States has won this war. They have been gleeful as they see us destroying our own power and prestige, and also wrecking our economy. Of course, the major effect on them will come when the world tips into recession and their export markets dry up. But no, I don't think that's the case. And the last time Donald Trump met Xi Jinping, which was in Busan, South Korea, it was a meeting of equals. I think we've been weakened, not strengthened, by this war in that context. Let me make another point, however, and that is we don't know how to do diplomacy. You mentioned Ukraine. I could mention Gaza. We can mention Iran. There's a common pattern here. In all these cases, the United States has sought some kind of nominal ceasefire, a phony ceasefire, a make-believe ceasefire, in which the other side is meant to ceasefire, while our side that we support doesn't ceasefire. These are what are called napkin agreements. They're little sketches in a cocktail bar of a possible agreement. There are no details on implementation. There's no meeting of the minds. They're entirely phony. And that is why there is no framework at all for a negotiation between the United States and Iran. The same is true, really, with China. The objective is not to achieve anything really significant, but to preserve minimal stability. That is, ensure that we don't get so much at odds that we go to war, which is entirely possible, and very devoutly to be hoped we can avoid.
Ambassador Freeman, before I let you go, I do wonder your general assessment of the negotiating, the actual people that Donald Trump has put forward. I mean, we have Mike Huckabee in Israel inviting Jonathan Pollard to the embassy where he's meeting with the traitor to the United States of America. Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff went to the talks with Iran in February without technical nuclear advisors and didn't understand the proposal that the Iranians were putting forward. Marco Rubio is completely MIA from any diplomatic contacts whatsoever. Not that I necessarily think people like Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry are good people. They're in my view, all war criminals. That being said, they did seem to have some understanding of the art of diplomacy and how these discussions are supposed to work on an international stage to get a deal done. Am I too pessimistic about the Trump team and what they're trying to, or how they're going about what they're doing?
Well, there is no team, really. There is no diplomacy. There are envoys whose only qualification is their personal relationship with Donald Trump. You mentioned Medvedev. He's a much bigger expert on nuclear matters than Steve Witkoff or Jared Kushner, who don't understand how to close a deal, apparently, internationally. I mean, they have a batting average of zero at this point. We used to have a first-rate diplomatic service. I was part of it. I was proud to be part of it, to serve the country for 30 years. That diplomatic service does not exist. It should have been reorganized, of course, and retrained to deal with the post-Cold War situation and the post-post-Cold War situation. It wasn't. And now we have empty embassies with no ambassadors. people are appointed to ambassadorships for no reason other than they gave money to the Trump campaign, or because they're able to escape the vilification of Laura Loomer or something. I mean, there's no real meritocracy here at all. And so you get what you pay for, and what we pay for is a bunch of bozos who don't know what they're doing. So it's like organizing a football team with your cronies and not training them, just sending them onto the field against an NFL team. You know what would happen. And we look around the world, we see people who are very skilled at diplomacy. Sergei Lavrov, Wang Yi in China, Araghchi in Iran. These are all professionals. We are mounting an amateur hour to our own great detriment. Sorry.
Absolutely. Ambassador Freeman, I can't thank you enough for your time on the show today. I have learned so much from you over the years, whether it's reading your articles, listening to your speeches, or your interviews with like Andrew Napolitano or Scott Horton. I mean, you really have so much insight on the diplomat process and how it's supposed to work. And it's really key when you see these talks going down, being able to have that deep understanding. So thank you so much for coming on my show today and sharing your wisdom. Everybody, be sure to like, share, and subscribe to the show. Help us get this video out there to more people, because all this information is really important. And we'll be back with another episode tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
This episode sponsored by We Feed Raw. Have you ever actually looked at the label on your dog's food? Most dog food labels are a long list of things that don't look like food. Powders, starches, additives used to hold ultra-processed kibble together. At We Feed Raw, the label looks very different. High-quality meat, nutrient-rich organs, complete and balanced nutrition formulated by PhD nutrition experts. No fillers, no artificial preservatives, just real ingredients that support your dog's whole body health. That's why many pet parents see real changes after switching to We Feed Raw's fresh meals. If you want to feed your dog one of the healthiest diets possible, We Feed Raw makes it simple. Right now, new customers can get 40% off their starter box plus free shipping. Visit We Feed Raw at wefeedraw.com to get started today.